John 15. Lord, who may dwell in your sacred tent? Who may live on your holy mountain? The one whose walk is blameless, who does what is righteous, who speaks the truth from their heart, whose tongue utters no slander, who does no wrong to a neighbor, and casts no slur on others, who despises a vile person, but honors those who fear the Lord, who keeps an oath even when it hurts, and does not change their mind, who lends money to the poor without interest, who does not accept a bribe against the innocent. Whoever does these things will never be shaken.
Psalm he's doing next week, and you definitely should come because I think it sounds really great. So I'm doing Psalm 15, and I want to start by going back in time a bit, which is a lot of time for you guys, for a lot of you. Who knows who Billy Graham is? Oh, good. That's really good. So if you remember, Billy Graham did some evangelistic crusades, and I'm going to play you something from the 1959 one in a second, because this is the kind of song that was really popular for a while amongst evangelicals and evangelism. Everyone ready to go back in time? All right. Brisbane, there you go, bit of history. This was a really popular genre of hymn at one point, that you'd be coming into worship, and this would be also when you're trying to get people to make a commitment to Christ, just as I am without one plea. Or there were other ones like, Jesus, take me as I am, I can come no other way. And these songs were such a comfort as you came into worship and you came up to God. That, you know, you didn't need to be, this is an old idea, but when I was a kid, you used to have to dress in your Sunday best. Obviously, we're not doing that these days. but it was great because they were about aiming to remove the barriers from people finding God. And they're founded in the knowledge that Jesus is our high priest, and through what he has done, we can approach God's throne of grace with confidence. That's Hebrews 4. So there was a beautiful truth they were expressing. But this psalm, Psalm 15, you've just heard, kind of does the opposite. It sets out conditions for entering into God's presence. But this is one of my favourite psalms. In fact, actually, when Andrew asked a few of us to preach during the holidays, he said, preach on your favourite psalm. And I reckon people were thinking of Psalm 23, right? The Lord's my shepherd. Or if that, do you know emo people love Psalm 88 because there's no hope in that? Like, it's just so negative. That's like your emo psalm. But neither of those, none of that sort of great emotion you get with Psalm 88 or the beautiful comfort of Psalm 23 and all its wonderful metaphors. There's like no metaphors in Psalm 15. This is a sort of very right to the point psalm. Now, but I love this. And one of the reasons I love this, and this is again going back in time, people, it's a bit of a history lesson here, but not as far back. There was this band that just did psalms called Sons of Korah. Anyone know them? Oh, a few people. Oh, wow. Okay. They played here in 2006. One day you're going to write, when you're an old man, Todd, you're going to write the history of Thornley Community Baptist Church. Just make it clear. There was a beautiful musical setting. I'll just play the first bit of it for you.
Who may dwell in your sanctuary? Who may live on your holy hill?
Don't worry, tomorrow. You get to hear more of it later. Well, why though, even if it's got a beautiful musical setting that I enjoyed, why have I found it so encouraging? Well, I'm hoping that I can take you on a journey. I kind of got there at least with some people at 4 o'clock. A journey to see why I find this so encouraging, that hopefully you'll find the same encouragement. Now, the first thing that's intriguing about this psalm is the type of conditions that are set out. So there were actually conditions to go into first the Jewish tabernacle and then the temple when it was built. And there were strict requirements for those who entered into the presence of God. And they became more strict as you became closer into where God was, the Holy of Holies, where the Ark of the Covenant was kept. And if the priest was going to go into that holy place, there were rituals of washing, there were special garments, there was a sacrifice you had to make. And then around that, there developed all sorts of ritual washings in Jewish culture that you had to do as you came into Jerusalem and the temple. And in fact, even and still to this day, an Orthodox Jew will wash their hands before prayer, because you're coming into the presence of God. So God's holiness was so immense that it required people to be clean and pure as they came into the presence of God. And this is why, in fact, it's so extraordinary that Jesus makes us clean, so that we can come into the presence of God just as I am. But Psalm 15 is interesting because it sets up requirements to enter into the presence of God that are different from those ones set out in the ritual of their religion. Now, it starts, as you might imagine, a pilgrim to the temple asking how they might enter in. Lord, or Yahweh, who may dwell in your sacred tent? Who may live on your holy mountain? Now, the same question is asked actually in another psalm, Psalm 24. In that one, the answer is the one with clean hands. Remember the ritual washings and pure heart. But in Psalm 15, there is no even slight reference to cleanness or purity. And so there's a bit of a challenge here, I think, to people who thought if they performed the rituals, if they did the washing, if they did the sacrifices, you could therefore be close to God. And it's a challenge that continues for us, because it's a challenge to any faith where you're going to be ticking the boxes. Because we slide so easily, I think, into a externalised way of how we do our faith. We say, I go to church on a Sunday, or mostly. I go to a small group Bible study. I go to youth group. I spend at least 5 minutes in personal Bible reading and prayer per day. When it's Christmas or Easter, I do my nice Christian post on Facebook. I get righteously angry when Christians have been treated unfairly by the media or the government. When we go into worship, I have emotional uplifting worship experiences, and I show it with my body language and my lusty singing. I attend the right conferences, whatever they are for my particular tribe of people. That is, people perform the current rituals of Christianity. Different from the temple time, but no less ritualistic sometimes. These are what mark people off as being committed Christians. But do they make us come closer to God? Do they bring us into the presence of God? This psalm looks beyond these external rituals of faith. In that day, the external rituals of purification, of washing, symbolise the purity of heart that brings you close to God. Now, in our day, we know that participating in worship or reading the Word of God can bring us closer to God, because they bring us near to ways to hear from God. But here it is, as with this psalm, this does not mean, if we do them, that we will definitely hear from God or come close to God. Because we need to be becoming the kind of person who can step into the presence of God. So this psalm looks at who is coming closer to God. It's the one whose walk is blameless. Now, walk in the Bible is about living your life in general. And the word blameless is the same word as used for sacrifice, so that you'd bring what was called an unblemished lamb, one that was, you know, a good lamb. And it's the same word, blameless. And so this psalm turns around that ritual idea of the sacrifice of the lamb and makes it about the kind of person you are. Now, this is a rather frightening start to this psalm, right? The one who is blameless can come into the presence of God. Who can come into the presence of God then, if perfection is required? Or are we just going to go, oh, well, not necessary anymore with Jesus. Jesus does it all for us, so I'm okay. No, but I think this psalm has things to say to us. In fact, the word here, blameless, was used of people in Scripture who were known to have sinned. So it's not about perfection. Rather, it means something more like integrity, a sincere and wholehearted attempt to live in accordance with your faith. Consistency. The person who can come into the presence of God is the one who does what is righteous or what is just. These are, if you're walking a life of faith, you also do right actions, just actions. And then we go from walking to acting to speaking. This person speaks the truth from their heart. Again, it's about integrity, that the internal speech of your heart must be the same as the external speech of your mouth. And as we come into speech, it reminds us that when we're acting in integrity in the world, it is always with other people. Speech is communication with other people. Our walk in the world, our action in the world impact others. And this becomes extremely clear in the next few verses, that it is the person who can come into the presence of God is a person who can be trusted in the presence of other human beings. I'll say that one again. The person who can come into the presence of God is the one who can be trusted in the presence of other human beings. Right relationship with God and right relationship with other human beings are inextricably linked. And this speaks against anyone who thinks that being a Christian is somehow an individual act. In fact, I think it explains a lot of bad Christianity. The idea that my standing with God is about stuff just between me and God, if I've gone to church, if I've read my Bible. It's not. And I think that's one of the most encouraging aspects of this psalm, strangely, that it paints for us a picture of the person of God as someone that you want to know, someone that you'd want to be around. Because I find it discouraging, and I don't know about you, when people are painted as great heroes of the faith, as very fine Christian leaders, but then you know, or you find out later, that the person is a known bully, or is narcissistic, or is creepy towards women. How can that person bring us close to God? The very next verse continues this walk, does, speaks pattern. And I think actually that pattern is there because the psalm is reminding us that every part of who we are, the whole person, must be being God's person in the world. Now, you probably, if you look at this, you won't have picked up that it's talking about walking because it's in the Hebrew. It's an odd little phrase. So it's here as whose tongue utters no slander. But in fact, in the Hebrew, it's whose tongue goes walkabout. So it's kind of like someone who you trip over your tongue, which is kind of what happens when you go to say something that's a lie or not quite right. That it kind of comes out a bit funny because you're saying something you know to be false. So the idea is here of slander or false accusations. This is not just sort of gossiping about someone. This is about speaking the untruth about someone, whether you knowingly know it's untruth or whether you haven't taken any care to find out whether it's true or not. And I actually see this all the time by Christians, even in the name of Jesus, where someone is so concerned with fighting for their faith or their rights that they speak falsely about another, whether that person is not a believer or just a different type of Christian from them. And a lot of that behaviour happens online. Somehow, it's really odd, we somehow excuse worse behaviour online, worse speech, as if it doesn't count, if it's not connected to these this kind of thing in the Bible, but the Bible didn't have online, but it did know about communicating with other people, which is exactly what we're doing online. It's a significant place for our interaction with people. In the next, this addresses the same kind of idea: does no wrong or evil to a neighbour. And your neighbour is someone you're in community with. It's not just the person next door. In fact, it could be those people that are in your Facebook community. It's all people you're interacting with. This is a really challenging verse, I think. We might think, well, I don't do evil towards another person. But it says, does no wrong at all to people you're in community with. That's tough. That asks for careful examination. To think, am I doing something wrong and not even realising it? How is what I'm doing in every part of my life affecting those around me? And then, cast no slur at others. It's slightly hard to translate this one, but it literally is something like, does not take up reproach against a friend. Again, it could be slander, probably more generally abusive language or dehumanising language. Or it's even been suggested it's when you refuse to hear someone speaking a justified criticism of one of your friends. Calvin, to go back in history again, spoke of this verse as the vice of undue credulity. That is, of believing something without good evidence. And it goes both directions. When we believe ill of someone without justification, or when we too easily dismiss the truth about someone because they're one of our people. All of this is pointing to very careful behaviour and very careful use of speech in community. It means for me weighing up with everything I do, the way that I act, the way that I speak, is it true? Is it going to help and not harm? Is what I'm doing here justified, or what I'm saying justified, so that more people might be protected? Or do I need to speak up here, no matter the cost to me, so that I can care for people? You can see that the whole psalm is about actively doing good and refusing to do what is bad in every part of your life. You know, we can often get unbalanced on this and think, oh, I was generous and I gave some money to poor people. But at the same time, we're speaking in ways that tear down those around us. Or perhaps we're someone who always speaks politely but very nice, but we never advocate for justice for the oppressed. But this psalm calls us to continually in all ways be acting for the good of those around us. Given that, verse 4 might jar somewhat if we move on to that. Because it starts with this: the person who can come into the presence of God is one who despises a vile person, but honours those who fear the Lord. And as a Christian, you kind of go, well, aren't we meant to love others? What's this about despising people? But actually, I think this is a really, really important principle that works for community. Because we need to understand this language is not about being unloving or not desiring the good of other people. Rather, it's talking about how I prefer people. Who's the person I approve of? Who's the person who has my respect? Who's the person who has my ear? Who influences me? Who's the person I'm promoting? We need to make sure that it's people who fear the Lord and not those who do evil. And that's really important when it comes to putting people in places of leadership or places of care of other people or places of influence. And in fact, when we think of the church, we often get this wrong. And in fact, I think in the recent couple of years, we've been having a real reckoning with that. When there's people who've been very influential in the church, but then there's sex scandals, bullying scandals. And if you read about those, and I've been reading about them because I want to know, I'm a leader, how do I become a bad leader? How does that happen? What can I avoid? But there's always flags. People say, oh, that person was difficult to get along with. Oh, that person was, you know, a bit aggressive. But they're such a good speaker. Oh, but they brought people to Christ. And the psalmist is basically saying, no, No. Do not promote such people. Do not put them forward. They do not bring you closer to God. You cannot be brought closer to God by people who are drifting away from God. It is those people who have integrity, particularly in their relationships with others, that can bring us more into the presence of God, so that we too can become this kind of person. And in fact, you know, character matters. When we lift up or give power or influence to those without character, in fact, we also become complicit in the evil they do. We need to protect other people from those people. And so therefore, while we should avoid slandering or saying untruths about another person, we shouldn't wink at wrongdoing. And again, I see Christians doing this. When they like someone, when someone's been important to them in their life, they'll get upset when people speak out about their wrongdoing. They say, oh, be gracious, forgive. But God's grace is about transformation, forgiveness and restoration. It's not about turning a blind eye to sin. It's about having a community in which people can be safe and grow. In fact, we see that in, as we go on in the psalm, in verses 4b to 5a. A person who can come into the presence of God is one who keeps an oath even when it hurts and does not change their mind. Now, this is not talking about changing your mind about anything, because sometimes you're wrong and you need to change your mind. I can think of a lot of people who need to change their mind about things. Rather, it's about keeping our word even when it disadvantages us. It's when you're keeping an oath about an important value or someone's welfare is at stake. You need to keep that no matter what it costs you. And then 5A is about money, the charging of interest and the accepting of bribes. And actually both of those are about looking after the vulnerable and the disadvantaged, even when that is to your own disadvantage. You see, in that society, the charging of interest had very bad consequences to the poor. There was a thing called debt slavery, that if someone was unable to pay the bigger and bigger debt that they'd got from interest being charged, they would become slaves. And so therefore, these verses are about people who are making themselves rich from other people's distress. Similarly, with a bribe against the innocent, is becoming rich at the expense of justice towards another. This is fascinating because these, I think, are directed particularly towards those who have wealth and power. And often, and even in the church, we treat the powerful as if they are closer to God, and they get away with more things. We expect better behaviour of those with less power, but those with power get away with things. And you only have to look at Australian politics at the moment to see this playing out. But this psalm is a strong comment against the way that the world judges. It says, though people like this might get all the riches of this world, they will not get the real treasure, and that is closeness with God. And if we think about this with ourselves, we might not be taking bribes. But if we broaden this out, this is about any of us getting advantage from the disadvantage of others. That's a sobering thought. Which of us can answer that by saying no? Aren't we all part of systems in which we have benefited currently and historically from the bad treatment of others? Just to take one example, that one of slavery that we see in this very psalm. There are people in slavery today so that we can have the latest fashion, so that we can have nice chocolate. This psalm ends with what's been called both a challenge and a promise. Whoever does these things will never be shaken. It's a sense of having a sure footing, of not tripping, that you will remain in the presence of God. And what it's saying to us, here's the promise, there is great reward in the end for integrity. But here's the challenge. If you do not see integrity and love towards others as central to your faith, you're going to put that very faith in danger. Now, I'm guessing that many of you are now feeling convicted, or I hope you are. But are you feeling joyful or encouraged? Because actually that's what this psalm does for me. Now, it doesn't do that for me because I think I'm a sinless person, far from it. It's not like I'm going, oh, well, I'm fine then. In fact, actually, this psalm is a psalm of David. So if it's written by King David, we can remember that he was far from sinless. And in fact, he might have written this psalm when he was thinking through and reflecting on the wrongdoing that he had been doing. What I want you to think about is what I call the joy of goodness. Often, I think we're tempted to think the way that the world does, that good is boring and a drag, but sin is kind of enjoyable and exciting and fun. And that's how we market ice cream, right? Anyone remember the Magnum Seven Sins ice creams? They were good. That's how we think about it. But in fact, what this psalm is about is that that way of living does not give you reward in the end. Rather, there is a deep joy in goodness, because how much more joy is there than to bring yourself closer into the presence of God? In fact, let's take a sneaky look at the end of the next psalm, Psalm 16. It ends this way. You make known to me the path of life. You will fill me with joy in your presence, with eternal pleasures at your right hand. Joy is found in the presence of God. In fact, what's here, a fullness or a satisfaction of joy. And what Psalm 15 has been telling us is we come into the presence of God and into joyous relationship with God when we deal rightly and lovingly in our other relationships. Now, this isn't a hoop that we have to jump to get our reward. Rather, it's that the two are necessarily linked. Because the joy that is found in God's presence is the joy of love. And that joy is available to all of us right now as we love others as well. And that's why I find so much joy and encouragement in this psalm. Not because I am someone who is perfect and I'm affirmed by this psalm, but rather because this psalm affirms my deepest ambition. It affirms the aspiration I have to be a person of integrity who loves others deeply. Against all the other ways that there are to be in the world, against my own feelings of the despair, that to strive to be good is a waste of time in this world. This psalm answers me by affirming that living in such a way, living in integrity, brings to me what I want most of all. You see, this isn't a psalm for the perfect, it's a psalm for the hopeful. It is a psalm for all of those who have felt the joy of goodness. And I think all of us have known that joy at times. It's that uplifting feeling when you've helped another and you've seen the difference it makes. It's the feeling, actually, that some of the most loved stories that we have in our culture bring up for us. Like in movies, like in Hacksaw Ridge, where the conscientious objector saves his soldier friends by dragging them through great danger to safety. The joy we feel as we see him doing that, even though we don't know whether he's going to live. It's the joy we find in the movie Life is Beautiful, where the Jewish father in the concentration camp makes the concentration camp a game so that his son will keep hopeful and alive. It's the joy in the movie Babette's Feast, where this servant comes into money through a lottery, but she takes every single bit of it and makes a beautiful meal for her community. These joys. This is reward. In fact, Tolkien put it like this. Christian joy, which produces tears because it's qualitatively so like sorrow, because it comes from those places where joy and sorrow are at one, reconciled, as selfishness and altruism, that is non-selfishness, are lost in love. And that is because love does this incredible magic, this alchemy. in that even if sacrifice has been demanded from us, even if to be good has been incredibly difficult, love makes it worthwhile because it gives us joy greater than the greatest pleasures this world can offer. Because, of course, think of the most beautiful story, the story of the joy set before him. And so Jesus endured the cross, from Hebrews 12. And after Jesus endures the cross, he goes to the right hand of the Father, that is, into the presence of the Father, and then all of us then living forever with God, with Jesus, the Spirit, as the redeemed people. This is the joy of integrity. This is the joy of goodness. This is the joy of love. This is the feeling I get from this psalm. As Paul says in Philippians, it's not that I've already obtained this or that I've already reached the goal, but that I press on to make it my own because Christ Jesus has made me his own. I want to leave you with that song that I played a little bit of, not the Billy Graham one, but of Psalm 15, because over many years, this psalm and listening to it with this music has given me so much joy. It's given me so much hope, and it's given me a renewed commitment to integrity and love for others as the pathway to joy. So I want to ask you to sit and reflect as we play this music and come into the presence of God with me.
Who may dwell in your sanctuary? Who may live on your holy hill? Who may dwell in your sanctuary? Who may live on your holy hill? Only he whose walk is blameless, only he who does what is righteous, only he who speaks the truth from his heart, only he. Sanctuary, who may live on your holy hill? Who may dwell in your sanctuary? Who may live on your holy hill? Only he who has no slander on his tongue, who does his neighbor no wrong, who casts no slur upon his fellow man. Only he who hates the vile, but who loves those who fear the Lord. Only he who keeps his oath, although it hurts. And who lends his money without usury, who accepts no bribe against the innocent man. He may dwell in your sanctuary, only he may live on your holy hill. These things will never be shaken.
two notes.